When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to My Turn. This time, it's My Turn, the podcast where we talk about a different movie that some of us find tangential, quote, whatever reason we want to go from one movie to the next. We somehow are going from Tarkovsky to David Lowry, a filmmaker responsible for a remake of Pete's Dragon from a number of years ago. I am here to introduce you to The Green Knight, a movie about fucking around and finding out. A movie about a colossal dumbass. A movie where no one knows how to pronounce the main character's name. A movie I liked very much when it came out, and I like it even more now. To discuss this, I am joined by the usual crew, Mr. Rob Zachney.
You know, I think it actually flows quite naturally from nostalgia, honestly. Like, there was I had forgotten what the conceit of the show was, and there was a moment I was watching it, and I was like, oh, this is kind of like Tarkovsky.
I mean, that's how we got here.
I know. Specifically, but I completely forgot. And I was getting Tarkovsky vibes from some of this.
A camera lingers for 15 seconds, getting Tarkovsky vibes from this film.
Listen, our show is effectively just a sequence of tangentially related scenes in podcast form. We've made a podcast dream sequence. Welcome, everybody.
That's true. And also welcome to Renata Price and Ricardo Contreras.
Hello. Thank you. Welcome to my mind palace.
Yes.
Please don't pick up that vase.
The Green Knight is a movie that I picked for us to watch next. To set it up a little bit, The Green Knight is a 2021 film from writer-director David Lowry, filmmaker behind movies like A Ghost Story, as I mentioned, the surprisingly decent Pete's Dragon remake. The next movie they're doing, after this is a Peter Pan film.
Sure.
Okay.
Well, live
based
up
on the 14. Yeah. You know what? The Green Knight's kind of loosely based on the 14th century poem, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. Stars Dev Patel as Sir Gawain and a host of other incredible actors playing just a bunch of weirdos. You know, we got Joel Edgerton, Sean Harris, Alicia Vikander. In The Green Knight, you know, Patel's character is a sort of aimless sort. He's an individual born into a family of legends. He's insinuated to be the son of Morgan Le Fay. It is very clearly inspired by King Arthur, the Round Table, though none of those names are actually ever said in the story. Gawain is not brave. He has accomplished no feats. And his mother has decided to cast a spell to essentially provide a reason for their son to kind of sit at this place, find some sort of inspiration journey to kind of like join these sort of like kind of like legendary fable-esque characters that surround the him and the family that he's in. So one evening, after being able to recount a story about his tales, having none to share, in the midst of a Christmas celebration, sort of a creature appears down a long hallway. The Green Knight, this sort of horrifyingly beautiful looking creature that is kind of a mashup of the earth and a human. It is a really striking design. And this Green Knight, with just the most exquisite voice possible, declares that they would like to propose a Christmas game in which someone should step forward, raise their sword, raise a weapon, however you attack the knight. That attack will be given in turn a year later. You have to seek the knight out.
Hold on, you can't just say a year later. You got to say 1 year hence.
One year hence. Apologies. Thank you, Kato. I did assign you that before we started this podcast. Was by the way, you need to remind me to use the proper vernacular. I think it's a year and a day, right? Or is it actually a year?
One year hence.
Yes. And but you know, our big old main character dumbass is like, "All right, I'm gonna get up here. I'm going to borrow a sword." The Green Knight kneels, puts their head forth. It offers no sort of attack, and Gawain decides to take this as an opportunity to slice the Green Knight's head off. The Green Knight picks up its head, it goes back on its horse, says, "I'll see you in a year," and everyone breathes a big sigh of relief because finally our main character has a tale to tell, and we'll just worry about the consequences of these actions a year from now. And that sort of sets up our story. This is a movie that I picked because I found it so striking at the time. It is very slow and methodical, but I think gorgeous and interesting. And the way it plays with reality and perception, I found to be very memorable, and was one that I found to be even more memorable upon revisiting. And by revisiting, I meant paying $15 to outright purchase it from iTunes because it was the only way to watch it in 4K. There was nowhere to rent it. Vice, I tried. I did my best to find a cheaper way to watch this the night before, and it turns out it was just paying $15 for the right to do so. But I am curious for Ren and Rob. You're the two that had not seen this film ahead of us watching it for my turn. Ren, what did you make of The Green Knight?
I love that you can put any number of images in sequence and call that shit a movie. I fucking loved that. I loved this movie so much. It was an absolute joy. I am going to rewatch it frequently. I could not have asked for more. Could not have asked for more from this movie.
Rob.
It's a new Christmas classic for one. finally another good movie for the Christmas rotation.
Yeah. Hey, the way you get the little jingle bells at the very end of the film, which felt really deliberate. Like I will, as an aside, the reason it feels deliberate is because David Lowery, the director, told the actor that was playing the Green Knight to pretend you're Santa Claus at this point. And so there's like a lot going on in that final sequence. But sorry, Rob, I was stepping on you continuing.
No, it's aside from that, it did cast a complete spell over me. And I think one of the things that kept occurring to me as I watched it, it is that it is one of the few films I can name that really and truly feels like it is set in a world where magic is real, that there is an essence of the film that is magical. Like things that went through my head as I watched it were when Alfonso Cuarón took the helm of the Potter films and made Prisoner of Azkaban. It reminded me a bit of, and I guess sort of a Cuarón disciple in some ways, Pan's Labyrinth, where the trick is, of course, that it's, you know, again, it's kind of a dreamlike idol. What's real? What's fantasy? But it feels fantastical. There are very few films. There's a lot of films that have magic, but like the magic exists as like it's visual effects or something, or the magic is too instrumental. It makes too much sense. It follows a neat logic. This film, almost from the first, feels like there is magic in this world and I don't understand it, and I don't know what it is doing or to what end. And because of that, the entire film has this air of real alien menace, but also like beauty that so few films sort of can evoke. In terms of visuals, I also found myself thinking a lot about, for instance, the Lord of the Rings series. But even there, like that is an adaptation of a story that follows much, much cleaner logic. Oh, I know where I was going with this. A character that Jackson cut out was Tom Bombadil. And this has become a meme, right? Bring back Tom Bombadil.
Yeah,
it's like Tom absolutely. Bombadil doesn't make sense in, he barely makes sense in the Lord of the Rings trilogy on the page. How could he possibly make sense in, in the film? And it's true. Like there's an air of like weirdness around that character, and that aside, that it's like, how do you weave that in? How do you even make it good and not shitty because he's going to do a little weird little rhyme and it's not going to make any sense what he's doing here. And this film kind of in some ways felt like we get our Tom Bombadil sequence. And it turns out, like, if you you create a character that is so clearly like in the world, but not of the world, mm-hmm. that like the mundane becomes utterly riveting and hypnotic because you have like you have no idea what the hell is happening or what the intent is that this character is like bringing into this relationship in the film.
Kato, I know that you had watched this film before. We're excited when I chose it. I think you and I were. I did not participate in the A24 special screening so that you could watch it a week before you could pay. The more expensive rental service is what you paid to watch this movie a week.
Before a week later, I paid streaming. Yeah,
yeah, slightly the first time. Less.
Well, here's the fucked up part that I didn't mention either is that I had already seen it in theaters, which is why I was like, I need to pay this money and watch it again with a couple of the people that were already like coming over.
I wish I had seen this in theaters. There are movies, you know, we talked about this in nostalgia, there are movies that I think are made for cinema, like a big screen. And this movie looks beautiful on my beautiful screens. But God, there are just some images that I never saw this movie on the big screen. And so I'm tremendously jealous that got to
if it's ever within like I don't know you could probably drive I would drive like 2 hours to see this if it had to take that long.
Kato Patrick renting I don't need another pandemic theater. But remember when you could rent theaters for like $100 and just sort of show whatever you wanted? We have an on-demand theater service so just Kato and Patrick can watch.
And honestly, it made me kind of sad watching it this time because my TV is like okay until you try to do anything HDR and then it kind of looks not great even though it's supposed to look better with HDR. And I was like, oh, I remember so vividly how kind of stunning the image was when I watched it in the theater. But anyways, I really enjoyed this movie. And like a thing that I was going to bring up that Rob kind of started with was actually a comparison to Pan's Labyrinth, which I think this even goes a step beyond that level of making the like magical and mundane kind of interwoven, where, you know, in Pan's Labyrinth, there's still this sort of separation. There's a threshold that is being crossed by the main character in that movie to like enter the kind of world of fairy tales, and the interweaving there is a little more, there's space between those two worlds in Pan's Labyrinth. And this, it is all the same. It is all on this level of like the second you leave any sort of civilization, the world is wild and magical, right? The entirety of the world is wild and magical, and the threshold exists only barely within the threshold of like the castle or of Camelot, whatever the buildings exist, you know. Really, really enjoyed this movie, and I've watched it like 4 times now. I didn't even make it all the way through this time because I was like, it's fine, I've seen it already like a ton of times. I'll be good. I got halfway through and then I was like, oh shit, it's 4.
Does that mean you at least made it to the Giants?
Yeah, I just got to fucking the God.
You can't watch this movie without seeing the Giants. You gotta see the Giants.
Yeah. I made it to the scene with the Lord at the end, right? Like, which also very memorable. So
yes.
The one thing I'll say is that like Kato, you suggest that like inside the castle walls there is an actual boundary line. I don't think it's super hard.
The Green Knight has been summoned. I think it's the only threshold that even exists, right? Yeah. There's a small bit of like separation where the walls seem to hold out most of the magic. And then obviously the Green Knight at the beginning breaks that almost immediately, right? By coming in.
Yeah, it's just the movie's really giving there is no inside, there is no outside. Like there are shots in this movie that are so deeply like these delineations make no sense, right? This is like one of the things that I was thinking about is that at the end of the movie, when we actually get to the Green Chapel is just like 100% indirect conversation with the end of Nostalgia, where the camera pans back to reveal that, you know, this like little bit of Russian countryside is actually within this impossibly large decaying chapel, right? And is like, none of these delineations actually work. I think this, it's so good.
It's interesting, Rob, that you brought up the comparison to Lord of the Rings, because one of my favorite shots of the movie is once where the journey has begun, where he exits the castle, and we get these like this broad, long tracking shot with the castle in the distance. There's the goat, and it's in so many other films when a character is going on the hero's journey, going on the quest. I can imagine that scene with like a larger overhead tracking shot and the Howard Shore. He's like, dun, 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 dun. And it's like, here he goes. And here, it's the saddest shit imaginable. It's like, you have this more like, sure, they're sort of, you know, if you want to be really empathetic with their situation, like a person lost or like thrust into a world of legends and they don't know how to find themselves. Also, they're just like a sad sack of shit. He's like, I don't know, I guess I'm out to go figure it out. And it's just sort of a sad beginning to this journey. And the camera lingers for so long in a way that as you see that castle and in what, yes, as Ren has pointed out, there really is no barrier between the magical realm, like the world is the world, but there is something about him going off on this journey to this place is not an inspiring or exciting journey. What he is leaving is the only solace there is from the true weirdness that is beyond these walls. And he begins experiencing that almost immediately. And it's not in a celebratory fashion. It is in a very kind of mundane, like there's no parade and flags for him.
I mean, the camera's going, it's really just like, watch this motherfucker trundle. Like this guy isn't gonna gallop. He's not gonna trot. This horse is gonna trundle. The horse is at one point doing that thing the horses do where they walk kind of horizontally, and you're like, why is the horse doing that? And the horse is doing that because this man doesn't know how to ride a horse. What do we do?
Also, the horses were apparently a nightmare on the shoot of this as well. Just not vibing with the filmmaker. Oh, no. I think it ends up working for the film and the character specifically, but apparently like that was like a constant source of an issue on set, was just these horses did not want to just go in a line.
It's one of those things that like you don't think about like when it comes to filmmaking, but it is working with animals like that is a expertise that both comes with like people on the shoot knowing what they're doing, and also like it helps if you have actors who've like done that. But the days when everyone's going to do their rotation through two or three B Westerns, those days are long gone. So I can imagine that, you know, now it's like a little bit more, you're taking your film in your hands when you're like, how much of this are we put on horseback? I want to talk about like the opening a little bit, because we're talking about boundaries. I think what is so interesting here is that Camelot already feels more like a limbo than a paradise, right?
This is not a cool place. That round table is depressing. King Arthur, or the equivalent, you know, the stand-in, is clearly
he's
dying.
He's haunting his own. He's a ghost at his own feast.
Yes. Yeah.
And when I need to commit to how I'm going to pronounce that. Like, Arthur says Garwin.
So here's what I'll say. So Gawain is like, when I was looking up the pronunciation, that is sort of the accepted pronunciation. They were asked, because this was a point of contention when this film came out, which is, why does King Arthur keep saying Garwin? And David Lowry, the director, basically said, I don't know. I just kind of let him say that. It was like, he was like, like Sean Harris can pronounce that name however he'd like. And he said, in a more serious answer, some of it's regional accents, some of it is, like, but it seemed like it was very much leaning into, go read David Lowry interviews. He's like, he's a super funny dude. Like, but it does seem like it was kind of, you can interpret it as leaning into the, what is reality of this entire story. Mm-hmm. I think practically speaking, it's Gawain, and Garwin is the mental faculties of King Arthur.
You know, he made it sound super convincing.
Joel Edgerton pronounces it Gowan. It is all
there are like four or five pronunciations throughout the
which
the,
is
the
like
course
if like g- given that you have like three different language groups also in the aisles, I can see where it can get a little crossed up. But when when Gawain is heading up into the castle, right, we get that shot of him running uphill into the castle, and it's all like wreathed in these like stark white gray clouds. Like everything is, there's no view, right? It's commanding height. You have a feeling of heights and power, but like, it's just this fog that they live in. And then, of course, yeah, you do have like this Arthur as a man who has already sort of receded from the present, right? He doesn't sit with the knights anymore. He's the head of the table, and the round table is now a space separate from him.
There's also the fact that, like, one of the other things I like about the castle is that, like, you know, to borrow something from that happens later in the film, the green's already in there. There is already like little bits of moss and ivy covering the cobblestones of the interior of the castle, which is again like gesturing at, you know, one of the film's primary themes. The other thing I want to return to the name for a second. The cool thing about the name to me and the fact that there's like three distinct pronunciations is also that like after that engagement with the Green Knight at the beginning of the film, people see Gawain in like three like wildly different ways. There's Gawain the actual dude. There's Gawain for the people who were in the room and watched him actually do the thing. There's Gawain the story. And then, like, there is Gawain, like, the prophecy that his mother is trying to build for him. And so, like, it feels like people are talking to different versions of this character, or at the very least, they are talking to who they imagine him to be. And so the fact that there's like these slight differences in pronunciations of his name really lands for me, especially when like the king is trying to make him into someone.
Right. It's yeah, there's so much myth making that is happening here. Like even again, like the fact that this is not necessarily naming Arthur, it's like, well, hey, man, when you see that sword, like, come on, we know what the sword is. And like, yeah, there's, yeah. and you know, and that's, you know, obviously, you know, gets even more prominence in, towards the end of the film. But during that certain sequence, but all this myth making is in some ways, I'm not sure how much of the movie is kind of luxuriating in this point, but it's sort of like what are the point of these myths, like that these characters have told about themselves and how pathetic these people may or may not actually be as a result of this myth making that has put so much pressure on our main character to come up with a defining feature of why they're legendary.
Well, one of the things that, so I think that is one of the tensions that emerges really quickly is that like Gawain certainly thinks that he needs to do something, that he needs to, like, he needs some sort of quest or story. Like, there's a great scene, like Sean Harris like owns the start of this film.
Yeah.
And first he has that quiet scene with Gawain as he, you know, in so many words, and I love how he speaks. He speaks like he is an epic poem. Yes. He's using thee and thy in a way that a lot of other characters do not. He speaks as a man who is already like got one foot both in the grave and in myth. But he is trying to get at this. It's a very pointed familial speech of, I do not know you very well, and I realize I have breached family obligations not knowing you very well, and so I ask you like, tell me a story of yourself so that I may know thee. And Gawain interprets that as, I have no stories about myself. He looks around, he's looking at the round table, he's a man without stories and deeds to his name. But that's not what Arthur is asking. He is asking to know the man, and this is ultimately like the quest he is going to be on. Is that, like, who are you? Who is Gawain is the question that he needs to answer, but the thing he thinks he needs to do is create a story. And so, you know, we get that exchange where he feels he's failed to give Arthur a satisfactory answer, and he has, but it is in part because he doesn't think there is a him. He doesn't think he is a complete person without this sort of defining deed to his name, and does not understand that, like, Gawain, the person, can have value to people in this room as well.
Yeah, I also think that this is echoed with the conversation with Essel right before he leaves, where Essel is the person that Gawain is, like, sleeping with, is the arguably a love interest in the film, right? And one of the things that she just says, that she says the thesis of the film out, like, she just, like, says the film's central question just out loud, which is, why do you need greatness? Is goodness not enough? And Gawain just doesn't have an answer for that. For why he needs it, for why he is doing any of this. He does not have a real answer yet. And I think that, like, the rest of the film is then him asking this question of himself over and over and over and over again until eventually he stops and in stopping asking actually finds something.
Well, and I'm not sure he has goodness either. You know, the thing is, mm-hmm. in part, he is such a character waiting for the fulfillment of this destiny, this idea that someday I'm going to be a knight, I'm going to go on my quest, that as you say, you hedge, like, is she the love interest? I don't know. Like,
she's an interest.
Right. Yeah. But like, it is not clear that he actually feels very much or deeply for her. It is not clear he feels very much or deeply for himself. He is just kind of this character who is hanging around marking time, which what is going to do with that gap year effectively in the tale. But like, you know, we'll get to that in a second. When he's given, he thinks he has a year before like facing this mortal threat. He doesn't really do anything with it. There is no sense of like, here's what I will do with my life.
Here's the training montage.
Not even that. But it's like, if you were told, like, you know, if you knew that the date and time and means of your death, you probably do things to resolve your affairs, right? You would probably like have conversations. You would do things to like fill your life. Gawain is given a gift to know this, and he spends it being like Camelot's biggest fuckboy. And that is, you know, he, as far as we can tell, he spends an entire year screwing and drinking and feeling sad about like what's coming and does very little else.
And absolutely hoping it will just disappear, right? Because even like,
and everyone is sort of not treating it as though, hey, buddy, you're going to go out there and get your head sliced off. Yeah. Like, it's, you know, again, the Green Knight calls it a game, and it, but you can see on Gawain's face, they are, whether they look at this as like a death sentence, they look at it as even just having to go on the quest is itself a death sentence, because having to achieve a journey, a tale, is having to come face to face with the thing they've been running away from, even though they think it defines them and what they should become.
Yeah. I love that the Rob was saying before about the way that he kind of doesn't answer King Arthur's question correctly, and that almost like beautifully dovetails into him misreading King Arthur, also telling him, remember, it's a game, right? Like, mm-hmm. he takes that shit way too seriously, and this is why he like he fails twice in that same exact scene, right? Once in not understanding what the question was, and not understanding what the actual, like, what he assumes courage means a certain thing, right? He assumes courage means not being afraid to enact violence when asked, and really it's like not being like he's terrified that entire time, right? Like, he didn't show any courage, and like him lashing out and like thinking the killing blow is the only way out of this game is being like afraid of what would happen if I sliced his arm off, he'll take my arm, like that would suck, but if I kill him, he won't be able to kill me back, right? The assumption
the Green Knight lays out the parameters of the game, like, you could just,
it's just a game, what the fuck. Come on.
Yeah.
But
because he assumes that pose
and the pressure,
it's a real baiting.
The pressure of just having been asked for a tale, right? The pressure of literally like a second before being like, so what's up with you? And then he'd be like,
Well, I want to talk about something else that is raised, because we're talking about like what is inside and outside the boundaries. I think something that's so interesting is, in Arthur's speech before the Green Knight shows up, when he asks for some merriment, but he gives the speech, basically it's a valedictory on the Knights of the Round Table and what they've achieved. He talks about, you know, they have shaped this land, that everything is marked by their hand and their deeds. And of course, when we go outside the castle walls, there's very little evidence that they have like that they have made the slightest impression on the wildness of this land, that like this is a story they tell themselves within the walls of Camelot, that what we have done is of historic import, that we have changed the world. And the second we see like Gawain ride beyond the walls, it feels within like 30 seconds that like the world has not taken note of Arthur or Camelot.
The first thing that he comes across, like the first like of his trials, is coming across a battlefield that is exclusively filled with the dead. And when someone is there, he goes, "Hey, what happened here?" And the guy goes, "Oh, everybody fucking who's gonna bury these motherfuckers? Everyone died." And then suddenly it's this like moment where this battle is completely devoid of context. There is not a war that has been suggested. There is no insinuation that there was a reason for any of this. This is just like,
did lines move? Did something on a map change because of this battle? Probably not, because everyone in the battle died on both sides, right? Like,
everyone died on both sides, and no character has made any reference to this. So, like, this is the thing about, like, yes, you're right, Rob. The speech rings wholly false, because the first thing we see is a battle that no one walks away from. And that fucking rules.
Well, and so, I couldn't, later in the film, I couldn't get out of my head, because, like, time does not seem linear in this world. Like, what's happening in time? There's a little part of me. It was like, is this his battle? Like, later, like when he foresees like what his time as king might bring, is this the fight? And he rides through the aftermath, sort of, because later in the film we see the scene sort of resets, that, you know, it's not even necessarily that a battle was fought here. It's like he wanders through a place where the idea of a battle where everyone died exists and continues to like reset the scene for people who who happen upon it. There is someday I may make us watch this movie. There is a World War One movie called Death Watch. It's a horror film where basically a bunch of soldiers in an attack wander off into a corner of the battlefield that is like haunted. And as the film sort of unfolds, like, you know, they have entered sort of a trial for the dead. Right. But, you know, the thing that emerges is that at the end of that, we see it resetting this idea that it's a form of violence that is so iconic and so like rich with meaning that it just keeps sort of recreating this tableau for new people to be drawn into. And I kind of like, you know, it kind of has that feeling in this film as well.
Speaking of horror, one thing I was really curious about, Patrick, is the horror expert on this podcast. A thing that I left this movie feeling was that, like, man, I wish more horror did fantasy, because I feel like horror has become so deeply associated with either the historical, the contemporary, or science fiction, right? Those are the three domains in which I feel like horror most frequently operates. And I very rarely feel like we see like truly fantasy horror. And after watching The Green Knight, that's the only shit I want to see from now on. Like, is this an accurate summation that like The Green Knight is a bit of a rarity among horror and like horror adjacent films?
Yeah, I would say fantasy and horror are not necessarily crossing over nearly as much. I think that's, you know, largely to do with the fact that so much of horror is trying to ground people in everyday things they can relate to, and fantasy is a bit distance from that. I think that, you know, it may be a limited view on how that works, but also horror as a genre works in extremely limited budgets. Fantasy already runs in the opposite direction of that. That said, like, this movie was made, relatively speaking, on the cheap, like chooses its shots when it goes to the fantastical, you know, really well. And so I think there's a rich vein to be tapped there. I think broadly speaking, though, it's like runs up against the budgetary appeal of horror when how those scripts are approved, because then all of a sudden you're building fantastical creatures and visual effects. It's
right. Clear. Ireland is the special effect in this film.
It's one of my favorite special effects in movies is the Irish step. Like, you can do whatever the fuck you want there.
I was reading a Reddit Q&A with David Lowry, and one of the extremely funny ones was the user deleted their account, so I can't even attribute it. But they wrote, "I was on your set when you were filming in Ireland. I got kicked out." And David Lowry responded, "Oh, no, apologies." And then the user responded again, "That's okay. I didn't know it was a movie set and just kind of wandered in." which is extremely good. You know, one thing we're like talking about here is all this Arthurian stuff. I have zero sort of connection history. Like, the most that I have with Arthurian Tales is the cartoon show that I showed Rob the intro of, I think last year, where there's a football team that gets sucked into King Arthur times, and then the football players become knights. Rob didn't believe that show existed, and then I showed him the intro, and it very much exists, and there's a Super Nintendo game that was made based on it. But
a whole TV?
Yeah. But
with licensed products? With like licensed video games?
Licensed product. Well, it's that's the nature of, no one owns the Arthur IP, so true, you get some different interpretations of
like
the work.
Merlin.
I mean, Merlin is here, sort of at the end here. Yes, Merlin.
He's there at the start.
That's true. Like, he doesn't really get called attention to towards the end.
There are little hint, like, things I love here. One is that, because we all know that, like, there's a few things that sort of canonically tend to break up the golden age of Camelot, right? One is the revelation of Lancelot and Guinevere's affair. And here we get the allusion to whoever is supposed to be at Arthur's right hand is not there. He is departed. And so while he is gone, Gawain can take that seat. And it feels in some ways like some of the signal events of the cycle have already happened, that we are sort of sitting in the aftermath of that. And then the other thing is that when the Green Knight rides in, and my God, as that silhouette that doesn't even really fully make sense. Like, it's a man on a horse, but like immediately, like, what shape is that as he moves forward? And we just get that look from Arthur to Merlin as to like, how should I play this? And Merlin gives that nod, basically like, we have to let this play out is the signal, right?
Yeah, cool.
Like,
don't be really chill. Cool, be chill. We cannot fuck this up.
But there is that sense of like, I think frequently the image of Merlin is as sort of the kindly wizard, you know, the court wizard and such. And here we get a vision heavily inspired by, like, let us say Rasputin, for instance, like a true court mystic.
Yeah.
And someone who, again, profoundly does not fit.
Yeah, this is Merlin the baby purchaser, not Merlin the wizard.
It may just be more a political figure, right? Like, does Merlin actually a wizard? I mean, obviously we have Morgan Le Fay who casts a spell that summons the Green Knight, but I think that's also, I like the ambiguity here. Merlin demonstrates no magical acumen. Like, the two things we get are of Merlin nodding in this scene, and then during the kind of imagined future sequence, he sort of marks, you know, Gawain's, you know, child.
I couldn't figure out, was that a stillbirth?
No, that was the baby that goes on to die in the imagined war.
Yes, but the baby doesn't start crying until Merlin marks it. Like, that is the one thing that, like, sat in that scene is, like, we're shown a difficult birth, or at least what seems to be a difficult birth, and then, like, a baby that's making no sound as a newborn, as I understand, is, like, not a great sign.
They tell you early on that's what you want to hear them screaming. I still took it to be that the baby grew up and then he had a second child with the arranged marriage.
The baby did grow up, but I'm saying, like, did Merlin do some magic?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, because that's the part of that scene that, like, it almost
there
seems
was a
like
lot of blood in
struck.
That scene, yeah. Right? You know, like, you know, the there's the shot where Gawain leaves, you know, a pittance of coins
it's so bad.
I never really thought, I had not considered that scene that way, but the amount of blood, now granted there can be a lot of blood in a labor, even one that is going according to plan, but that's an interesting reading on it that I hadn't considered and could fully buy if was told it was true.
It also, like, is leaning into the, like, the visual language of magic, which this film has established, right? The visual language of magic that, like, works in The Green Knight is that cause and effect are pretty clearly separated from one another in a way. Like, people do things, and then a little bit later, something else happens, and you kind of are supposed
they are
to kind
approximate, of, but not direct.
Right. Yeah. Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Right. Someone will do something, and it's just like, why the fuck did that guy do that? And like 30 seconds later, it'll be like, is that egg sprouting?
I wonder. So the other vision of magic we're shown here is that, yeah, Morgan Le Fay has her chanting circle going. And I think it is so fascinating that they appear to be instantiating the legend of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight into the world, that what she writes out and burns as an offering to get to fire the spell is like a rendering of the opening of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. And there's that kind of put me in question, and I'm curious what y'all make of it. What does Gawain's mother intend for him? She creates the story. Like, does he keep failing and the story reaches a resolution? Like, what does she want by bringing this character and this story into the world?
I presumed it was opportunity, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know that the conclusion was written, but he was incapable of seizing an opportunity to resolve this part of himself. And it was never going to happen without a kick in the ass. And I took this moment to be her invoking an opportunity for her son to do something and to define themselves one way or the other, whether through success or failure.
I think it felt to me a little bit like she's kind of bought in on the whole, like, you know, you gotta strive for greatness to like make it in the court, right? Like you're trying to like stand out in some way.
You want to be king?
Yeah. You want to be king. You gotta fucking do something. You gotta move. Go ahead.
Oh, I was gonna say my only thought here is that like she Rob's right. She instantiates this whole thing, right? Mm-hmm. She speaks into the world this legend, right? And I think part of that is she knows from minute one what the function of the belt is, and so she has an outcome in mind, right? Like if all of these rules are the rules that they are,
yeah.
Then she has the outcome in mind is that he takes off the belt. That is her end goal.
I don't think
is for him to.
I don't think that is. Because to me, she makes the sash doesn't get made until later, doesn't it? Or am I misremembering when it gets made?
So no, that's at the loses start. It and gets it back under different circumstances.
Yeah. Oh yeah, he gets everything
back. I know, but okay, yeah. Like when does she make the sash? Is it after the game happens?
Leaves. Yeah.
Before he leaves. Yeah. This is what I'm saying. The game was like an opportunity. He took it too far. She's like, oh fuck, I gotta cover for his mistake, and therefore makes the sash. That's how I read it. Was her being like, well, you weren't supposed to go that far, but this sash will get you through it. Like, you'll be able to survive with the sash, right? Because it's not like the sash is made as part of bringing the Green Knight around. It's made after the fact. In that year, she makes it at some point.
But she knows it's a game. Like, that's my only qualm, is that, like, she knows that it is a game at its core. Because...
I think forces us to just... like to frame this entire conversation around what we think happens at the end of the film.
Well,
fair.
I think, see, this is like, I actually like both readings. I think this is one of the delightful ambiguities of the film.
Yes.
I think there is a version of this where I do think she creates the opportunity. She brings the stranger to the door and he mishandles the situation and places himself in mortal jeopardy. And she tries to bail him out of it by giving him a charmed object.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Other version of it is she foresees all of this and she is creating a story in which her son at the start of the film, who knows not who he is or what he wishes to be, finds the direction and meaning that he lacks. But you could equally read this as Gawain is terrified of the implications of what he has done. He's terrified of his own death, but also he is burdened by the love of a parent who the worst thing in her world would be something bad happening to him. And he has to cast off the charm that she has created for him and accept that, like, he will bear consequences on his own shoulders.
Well, let's do that framing about the ending, because I think it's going to inform a lot of how we talk about what happens on the journey itself. So let's take a break, and you won't hear an ad if you sign up at Waypoint Plus at waypointplus.com. But everyone else, we'll be back in just a moment.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And we're back because Ren was alluding to it, and I just feel like it'll unpack a lot of other things that kind of spring out of it. I almost made this the first question of of this discussion, and chose to push it a little bit further. But you know, the end of this film, you know, Gawain, you know, after many trials and tribulations and screw ups, makes their way to the fabled Green Chapel, finds the Green Knight, lays down the axe that they have brought with them, that was granted to them by the Green Knight, and spends what appears to be 24 to 36 hours hoping he opens his eyes, trying to figure out what he's supposed to do next. I think he gets there a little before Christmas, and I think the Green Knight does not actually awake until Christmas proper. And which the whole notion of Christmas is calling it explicitly Christmas is a whole other part of the mythology and lore in this world that it is just really interesting. But eventually the Green Knight opens their eyes, asks, indeed, is it Christmas? And is then essentially says, like, all right, you're here. You did it. We're going to let's do this thing. And multiple times, Gawain flinches, asks for more time. There's an extended vision of the future that we can get into separately, but even just jumping past that, eventually Gawain takes off the sash, in theory magical object that is going to prevent them from being injured. The Green Knight kneels down beside them and says, with a very Santa Claus like chuckle and a smile, well, now off with your head. And then the movie cuts to a title card with some awfully jubilant music to go with it. And
oh, what a score. What a soundtrack. What a score.
I listened to it while I was prepping for the podcast and thinking about the discussion. But go ahead, Ren.
I was going to say, A24 loves nothing more than a choral wail.
They do. But it begs the question. The ending is open to interpretation. Ren, what do you think happens at the end of this film? Do you think Gawain is absolved of their journey? Has this all been truly a game?
Well, we left out that post-credit sequence.
So the post-credits does not have narrative implications, I should say.
Oh, okay. Wait. By who? By the director's own?
Yes. He said it was a cute. He said it was a cute thing they caught on set, so he put it at the end of the movie.
That's very funny.
That rules.
To explain, there is a as the credits are finishing rolling, essentially, like behind the credits, there is a scene of the young actor who plays Gawain's daughter during that extended sequence of the kind of a vision into a potential future timeline, playing with the crown and putting it on their head, which you very much could take to mean, and people have taken to mean, that, oh, Gawain does survive, the Green Knight does not actually lop off their head. But David Lowry has said that, like, you know, people can believe what they want. He's like, it's ambiguous for a reason, but he was like, if you want my honest opinion, that was just, I just thought that was cute. And so I put it at the end of the movie because someone had a camera on while they were doing setting up for a different scene.
God, I think I am interested in the world where Gawain, it's a dream sequence, right? His future is a dream sequence, and Gawain is like, I'm gonna take responsibility for this. And then the Green Knight is like, good job, buddy, you did it. Because this leans into the, it's his mother's plan. My thought that it is his mother's plan for this to play out this way.
My reading is, motherfucker's head came off. Like the game was afoot, the game was completed, and the game still involved your head chopping off. You can still, you know, have completed this emotional hero's journey, but I believe at the end that the head was severed clean, and the game was completed.
Well, the thing I'll say here is that, again, like, my feeling watching this film is that, like, the cycle itself, the story itself, is like swirling around Gawain on his path. Like, there's that entire shot where he like dies tied up in the forest.
Yeah.
And his journey ends there. And like we come back to the tale continues. And so I in some ways I think, like, you know, multiple interpretations work here, because in some ways like all of it's happening at once.
So the dream sequence that I talked about at the, or potential dream sequence or future seeing at the end, also completes with the camera making a full 360, doing a panoramic shot of the entire room, during which things do change, which is, again, the fascinating thing is that, like, you know, during that process, like the it is not just a panoramic shot, is it a panoramic shot during which time is also and events are occurring that you can't see.
That shot is so fucked. There are so many incredible shots during that sequence too.
And then also the other thing I'm thinking is, like, the symbolic and the literal are treated as the same thing frequently throughout this movie, which is why I think that there's a chance that the Green Knight is like, yeah, saying off with your head is enough, is because other people at various points will substitute the symbolic and the literal and be totally fine with that. That's my only thought, Kato.
Yeah, no, I feel like it's definitely like, I don't know. Yeah, it's up to, like, I can never really pin down what I believe happened, really, because there's so many ways you can read it. And it's like, is him drawing, because he literally draws his finger across his neck, right? Is that like Ren saying, that symbolic gesture enough? Is that just him presaging, like, okay, and we're gonna do it next? I'm just teasing you at this point because you finally fucking took off the magic sash that I knew you were wearing, and I'm just taunting you. Is that, like, you know, you can, there's so many different ways to read it that I've always kind of been, I guess, more interested in, like, what it says about what Gawain believes that he's taking off the sash at that point, and, like, whether or not he lives or dies after that, kind of, I don't know. It feels like it matters less at that point, but, and I guess if I had to choose one, he does die, because it's kind of feels like the story can be read a lot.
He still completes the emotional journey.
Right. It can be read about knowing the end is coming and how you deal with that knowledge of your own demise and mortality, right? Like,
my only other thought is that he says, I will return the blow to you in kind, right? If you do this, I do this, et cetera, et cetera. With the knowledge that the Green Knight himself is immortal. And so it is a beheading to an immortal. And so to behead an immortal is something fundamentally different. It is a symbolic gesture to cut off the head of the Green Knight at the beginning of the film. And so in making himself mortal at the end, Gawain makes it so that the Green Knight literally cannot return the blow in kind if he uses the actual axe. And so it then transforms that into a symbolic gesture.
Yeah.
And so it's exchanging it's like through the removal of immortality, the literal and the the word I've been saying for the last like five fucking minutes are interchanged for one another.
Symbolic, I think is what the word is.
Symbolic, yeah. Thank you, yes.
So something for me, though, like his vision or dream, to me it feels like a vision of a world where he flees. It's kind of like he gets a lot of what he might have dreamed he wanted, but in other ways, he never stops running. That he is a, that, like, it is a decision born of selfishness. and cowardice, and the selfishness and cowardice becomes a thing that keeps like reverberating through his life. Mm-hmm. We see him ascending to, we see him getting a hollow knighthood from Arthur, unable to confess that like he didn't do the thing.
Right.
We see him ascend the throne and fight wars as a king, but of course his son that he took from his lover, his natural son, is killed in the battle in his place. And then ultimately, he becomes the ruler of, we see somebody like throws, I don't know, rotten fruit at him or something, but like, somebody taunts him on his return from this war, and he can hear his soldiers killing civilians,
castle. Holding like the crown, but some sort of piece of headwear that was on his son's head as he comes back from that fight.
And so for me, when I think about that vision, in some ways it is like there is something there for him to reject, right? It is the person he becomes if he's the sort of person who shrinks from this, who leaves. And at the end of that, he is like sort of conceding that, having sort of lived this lifetime in this moment, he deems that ultimately that life wasn't worth preserving. And so he agrees to take the blow, he removes the sash. He agrees to take the blow. And at that moment is transformed. In that moment, he is given this mercy because now he has completed the quest, which is this quest of like, both self-knowledge and outgrowing this kind of like selfishness and fear that has sort of marked him from the start.
I also think go ahead, Ren.
Oh, I was going to say the other thing that to Rob's point is that like, if this is a movie about legend, right, then to me, it accepts that what we are going to watch is going to, instead of following like, causal logics, is instead going to follow like what is the most resonant conclusion to this story, right? Like it is trying to like in being a legend and being about myth, it is going to choose the most archetypical and like immediately readable ending possible. And I think this is like to Rob's point about, he does the thing. This is the moral of the story, and legends and myths by their nature have a moral logic to them. And without this moment, if he dies, the moral logic collapses.
Part of what I think is really beautiful about that sequence too, is so frequently when we get the equivalent in any sci-fi fantasy, like take your pick on here's a glimpse into a potential future. It is given to the individual as opposed mm-hmm. to believed and thought of by the individual. And so if you go through the thought experiment of what Gawain is doing in that moment, if you were to sit with yourself and think, what are my worst possible qualities that define me? How do I extrapolate what that would happen over a lifetime? Well, one, that's like really heavy. But two, the fact that, and I think is what gives the moment so much more weight, it is not, hey, and by placing my axe near your head, the magic is going to show you a possible future, like a Scrooge like scenario of like this is one thing that could happen. And instead it's him. It means more when it's you're reckoning with what you, your own perceived faults, your own perceptions of how you would corrupt as a result of an extrapolation of where you are currently in your life. And it gives that moment just, I think, a lot more meaning regardless of what happens when the axe does or doesn't come down.
Well, and it fulfills what Joel Edgerton's Lord is getting at when he sort of is interrogating Gawain at his fireside one evening, where he's asking Gawain about his quest and asking really probing questions like, what is it you want? And all his questions can be interpreted two ways, and Gawain keeps interpreting them one way and being told like, I meant it the other way.
You're really bad at questions.
One of the things that like the Lord asks when he sort of hears about like how this is going to raise him to knighthood and like be this quest, he asks like, making a jest of it. So that's it. Like you do this and you become, you have honor. You do this one thing, and a moment ago you did not have honor and you were not a knight. And then a moment later you have it. And it almost, like, does he not get it? No, actually he gets it quite well. The thing is, Gawain doesn't get it. Gawain thinks like honor is this thing that he can go out and win, that it's like you do the thing, now you're an honorable man. And what the Lord is driving at is that, like, the change comes differently than that. That honor is a thing that you have or you don't, but it is not a thing you can just like check a box and possess.
And for me, like, the lifetime of decisions he imagines from that point forward. One of the things I really love about the future seeing dream sequence, or dream sequence, quote unquote, is the fact that there's no dialogue for 10-15 minutes of movie, of just showing him in these vignettes doing actions, right? Like, he is the only person in those sequences who is acting on the world. It feels like, right? Those are all decisions that he is making, and then their immediate outcome. No one else speaks. No one else does a thing. He is just like the recipient of the world, and he is the sole actor. And in being the sole actor, constructs a world where he makes the wrong decision every fucking time. And so ends up making the end of the movie really feel like him making the right decision for the first fucking time in this movie, because this idiot.
Or making a decision, right? Like, I don't even know. Mm. I think you could even be like bigger than just a good or a bad decision. So much right. of the way the character is portrayed up until he goes on some of these kind of like, you know, journeys along the way is just making a decision, like, be a bad person, fine. At least you've made a choice to, like, be some, to represent something, because he's being told he needs to represent, you know, all these, you know, values of a knight, but you can also view Gawain as an individual that represents nothing at all. Like, mm-hmm. It doesn't even represent good or evil or anywhere in between. You're just floating along and things happen to you.
Right.
It feels.
Go ahead, Kata.
One of the readings I had, one of the earlier times I watched this movie too, was definitely feeling like it felt a little bit like, you know, obviously these movies are these sorts of tales are all about like chivalry and like the code of the knights and what abiding by that code means, that you're like, you know, worthy of praise and all that, like. The legends kind of putting pressure on Gawain in the beginning really tinted the whole thing as kind of a sideways meditation on, like, especially because at the end he like becomes a king, a sideways kind of meditation on like just the structures of patriarchy and the pressures mm-hmm. that are put on men. And that's, I think, why originally I might have read him as dying at the end. It's like, well, in order to break the bloodline because of the way society's broken up, you just have to die and not become the next king. As like a more structural sense of like, the reason things go bad is just because, you know, fucking this the feudal system is not good. But that's like extrapolating to a more like structural level than like a personal level, where like he does do the right thing, but like maybe as a symbol for the next generation after Arthur, being like, maybe we shouldn't keep doing the exact same thing that everyone else was doing before us.
One of the sorry, Patrick.
No.
I was gonna say, one of the other interesting things like I find about this is that I wonder if one of the things in this movie is that like Gawain not only cannot like figure out his own life, but cannot understand that myths and legends operate on a moral logic, right? Like, he cannot read the story of anyone before him as a text. He cannot derive actual meaning from it. Instead, he's just trying to recreate the literal actions of previous people.
Right.
And this gets to what you were talking about, Rob, with the question at the beginning of the movie, tell me a story from your life. Tell me who you are. And not only can Gawain not like produce a series of actions, he cannot produce like a meaning, right? It is both things at once. And so the moment he goes on a quest, he just tries to reproduce actions. And without understanding that there is an underlying moral logic, which, you know, leans into this like meditation Kato's talking about the like broad archetypes of patriarchy and the way that like meaning passes down and is constructed in masculinity.
And there's like two things worth sharing. One is, so Lowry was asked, you know, when the film came out about like, hey, what happened? Do you like have any read into it? And so it's worth reading for this Vanity Fair piece where Lowry wanted to use an extended sequence to achieve something very specific. He wanted to write an ending where his head gets chopped off, and that's a positive thing. That's a happy ending. He faces his fate bravely, and there's honor and integrity in that. But that doesn't mean he's dead. He's killed. He received the blow that was dealt, and all is set right within the universe of the film. And then he goes on to say, Lowry said he shot a more, quote, explicit and, quote, definitive version of the ending, but that it put, quote, too sharp a point on the film. Quote, people, it is quoting from Lowry here, which again I should point out, go read anything with him, he's extremely funny. Quote, if people were to watch a movie in which Dev Patel gets beheaded at the end, they probably would feeling differently than they do with the more ambiguous version. That ambiguity may leave the ending open to a rotation, which Lowry is fine with. Quote, even amongst ourselves, Dev, my producers, and I, we all had slightly different ideas about what the ending means. If we cut to black, what happens next? And then related to that, Last Galaxian wrote in, this question contains spoilers for Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. So spoiler alert for a 14th century Middle English story, I guess. Anyway, I'm one of those dweebs who read the story back in college, and I think the movie does an interesting thing by leaving the viewer moments before the story's written conclusion. In the end of the tale, the Green Knight does not, in fact, cut off Gawain's head, nearly nicking the back of his neck, and lets him go merrily home to King Arthur's court. Well, that clearly won't be his path in the film, and then asks us basically what do we think happens at the end. But we haven't gotten into the sort of like the specifics of what happens differently, but I think it's interesting that Lowry is like picking elements from the original poem and then choosing to cut them off at different points to sort of illustrate the specific narrative that he's telling here. Because when I was reading up on the original poem, I mean, one, it's a much more lighthearted affair. Mm-hmm. And two, like the journey that Gawain goes on is just implied. Like, it's just like a line that's like, and things happened. And then he got to the Green Chapel.
Question. Does he still get the cum belt in the original poem?
I didn't know how to. I was trying to think of a question. You brought it up, and so Ren, the floor is yours. Cum belt pro, for against.
Listen,
too much, not enough. Did the shot linger enough? Did you really need him to squish it? A little bit.
The squish is the grossest shit I've ever seen in my life.
It's so bad.
It would not have been an A24 movie from between the years 2019 and 2021 without some reference to masturbation or coming. You know, like Robert Pattinson walked so Dev Patel could run with the cum belt.
Did you know the original script for The Lighthouse, even after, I believe, Robert Pattinson had been cast, but before, like, the funding was taken care of, mm-hmm. was supposed to do a shot that cut to a fully erect penis that was going to be Robert Pattinson's erect penis.
That sounds good.
Financer said, look, the movie's already weird enough. Get rid of the boner. And so
they didn't let him hang, dog.
As a culture, we have been robbed.
God damn it.
Because you know he would have done it.
Absolutely. He is a total weirdo. I love it.
It wouldn't even be like a sex thing for him. It'd just be like,
this is art.
Robert Pattinson just wants to be a little freak.
Yes. Yes. But I mean, all of that, I think, does set up something I wanted to ask about as we get towards the back half of the discussion on the movie is, we could spend an hour on each of the like sort of like knightly virtues that come to represent the different quests that like kind of mini quests that happen during the journey aspect of this film. But I'm just so curious if everyone has a favorite moment or something they wanted to sort of call out that really spoke to them in a different way. Kata was there. You've seen this movie the most amount of times
probably,
of any of us.
I think so, yeah.
What is, is there something about that, you know, our chunk of the film that really stood out to you, especially upon rewatch?
The Lord chunk is what you were saying?
No, like we've got the giants, we've got
this is a thing I realized this time around was that in my mind, every time I finish watching this movie, that the Lord chunk is like, that's like the last quarter of the film, right? Like it's the second half of the film.
Yeah.
It is an entire half, even though for me, a lot of the other stuff's like, because it's so like segmented that way into like these parts, I thought they were all kind of like equal lengths. They feel equally as important, even though the Lord, the stay at the Lord's Manor is the longest of them.
No, I think it's like everything post Gawain leaving castle. You know, you get, you know, when he gets tricked by Barry Cogan, my favorite man. When this guy shows up in a movie, he's gonna be just the weirdest guy. And every time I am going to enjoy it, he plays another completely weird guy in the Banshees of Inisherin. I like cannot recommend him in that movie more, but like anything from that chunk where there's so much we could talk about, but we won't have time for what stood out to you.
Like one of my favorite for just how like there's something really interesting to me about how this mixes what we understand as Christian iconography and also like obviously pagan beliefs of magic, right? Like and like obviously Christianity has always had this like weird intermixing because of how it came about, especially in England and all that, like how those things kind of were taken in at the same time. And I really enjoyed the like the Saint Guinevere scene and like like that to me is like that's just a fucking witch in the woods, my guy. Like that is a classic, like sorceress like hanging out in the middle of a fucking cabin, like, but no, wait, she's a Christian saint, so she's good. It's okay. It's okay magic. It's good magic. But there's a lot of just very striking visuals in that scene that like the time in the pond, this pond that seems at first like what, it's like 5 foot pond, man. You probably stand up in that pond, and then he goes down, and it looks like there's a fucking lake's worth of water in there. The way the color changes, and the like, it's just beautiful, and always like one of the most visually striking moments, like along the journey that I really love, and just, and then it's like having all that be associated with a Christian saint. It's just really, I don't know. It's a wonderful moment. Yeah,
well, and in keeping with like who Gawain is and who he's turning into over the course of this film, also he's like, oh, what do I get if I do this?
Why would you ask? The amazing thing is that this comes right after the scene with the thieves, right, where like he first of all doesn't give enough, and then he realizes, oh, we exchange things out here apparently, so I should get something in what he learns from the first fucking story is that he should ask for something, and she's like, what the fuck are you asking, like what do you know, that's you learned the wrong fucking thing, my guy.
He can't learn moral logic. He can only replicate actions. It's fucking it is incredible.
It's such a good moment of her being like, how dare you? What the fuck? What are you asking me this?
Such a good line. It's so funny.
It's so funny. It's so good. Yeah. Love it.
Rob, any moment from this stretch of the film that you found particularly interesting?
Fox friend. Fox friend. I love
weird
that little fox. It's
also,
so well animated. The little like,
when does little fox appear to you?
So doesn't the fox show up in the woods? Yes. Like near the start,
super
when he's
fucking early. Yeah.
Yeah.
There was
the fox is sort of dogging his steps. Yeah.
I definitely like did not catch him in the cabin scene the first time around, but he's there too, and I'm like, oh, he's been there the whole fucking time. He's just like skidding around. It's very that was one of the things I noticed, maybe just because it's a slightly different viewing, but he like popped out a little bit a few more times than I realized the first times the first time I had watched it.
It's just like one, it's just cute as a goddamn button. Yeah. Like just the, this little paws, so this little hops when he throws the rock at it to make it run away. And it just circles around to the other entrance to the cave and peeks its head out, is just like murderously cute. The way it like finds the hunters. I was so in suspense over like, he's staying in a hunter's house. He brought a little fox to a hunter's house. Oh no, little fox friend. But you know, then ultimately the reveal that the fox is a guide on this journey, that ultimately the fox is going to pose his penultimate choice, before he goes to the chapel.
Well, there's also about the hunter's house and the fox. There's a painting in the hunter's house showing the hunter following the fox. And then as Gawain is going to leave, Gawain is the person being hunted in that painting. And so like the fox starts to mirror Gawain. And that's the thing. The last question it asks is, bro, just the last thing it says, like, just go back, dude. Like the fox is Gawain at his most. At the most himself version of himself right now. Maybe a little bit clever, I guess, but also kind of just following other people's actions and fundamentally terrified of what could happen if he does anything on his own. And then that's why the fox's final message is really like, are you sure you want to do this, buddy? I don't think we need
Nobody
this.
Has to know.
Yeah.
Like this idea that like, what is shame if you're the only one who carries it? Like what is the meaning of shame when nobody remembers the thing that you shrank from? And ultimately he pushes on with it. But yeah, everything with the fox just ruled.
Ren, how about you?
So my favorite part of the movie has to be during Dev Patel's 40-minute horny house when when the speech that the woman gives, like the monologue about the green, is one of my favorite things I've seen in a minute. It's just it's an incredibly well written monologue. It is tremendously delivered, and just like cutting back to Gawain's completely blank, utterly
just sinking into the chair.
He has no idea what the fuck she's saying. He has no idea. He got like half of that. At best, and the half he heard, he did not like. And it's just so excellently done. And also, like, man, I love it when a movie is just like, hey, do you want the key to understanding the visual language of this film? This character is just going to kind of explain how to read this text visually, like real quick, and then we can get on with the rest of it. And it's so good.
Well, hey, she's a filmmaker.
Yeah, yeah, she makes a camera. She made a camera.
Yeah, that shit was.
He's like, what a weird portrait. And then it's hanging, sightless
it's
grandma
hanging here, right in the like behind him in the imagined sequence when he's sitting at the throne.
But it's no longer inverted. It's no longer upside down when it's hanging behind him, which is fascinating.
Yeah, there's a million little sequences, but I have to admit, I got tingly the first time it happened, and I found it even more impactful the second time is when the giant.
Yeah. Ooh, got those good tingles.
Ooh, tingly what, cum
what's
bones.
Alicia Vikander doing here Ew. Again? Who is she this time?
The Giants.
No, Double those are, trouble.
The Giants are who I was sexually attracted to in this film, Rob. you're like, you're taking, you know, you're robbing me of my moment. There's just, like, when we were talking earlier about, like, what is the scope of the danger or wonder and awe of this world? And it starts so small with just a castle and lords and ladies. And sure, we get, and it just escalates slowly over time to the Green Knight and then, like, the casting of the spell by Morgan Le Fay. And you sort of feel like even at that, like, and even with the introduction of the ghost, like, in the cabin, I don't know, it all feels within the realm of what this world is operating in, and the moment with the giants is just, it's just, I was just awestruck by the scale of it, the interaction that the fox has with the creature, even Gawain's, you know, it sounds like he could have gotten his ass lifted and like walked across his valley had he not done exactly what he was going to do later with the Green Knight, which was flinch, and then cause, you know, the giant to no longer want to interact with them. But there is just the way it's shot where it's not you know, it's a combination of a visual effect, but also clearly actual people being sort of like imposed on top of it. It's just a beautiful rendering of a world that I don't need to know more any more about it, but it just speaks so much about the world that it doesn't like get me thinking like, well, where are they going? But it's just such a cool carve out that even though it has zero impact on the story, what it says about like Camelot and its place and the myths these people tell themselves. It's like they tell themselves tall tales and to make themselves feel important. And out here are motherfucking giants just like going across the desert.
But also that in some ways to me, it also feels like that locked in. There was a point earlier in the film where he's riding along next to a bluff. And what looks like, I was like, is that a rock formation or are those the bones of some like great beast? Like there appear to be slightly overgrown bones like embedded in the hillside of like a creature that like humans have never interacted with, you know, in our history. But this it when I saw the giants, I was like, OK, now I'm pretty sure the film is making this argument that like magic is maybe leaving the world a little bit too. Wherever the giants are going, it is they're not coming back.
These are the elves leaving Middle Earth. Like, yeah. Peace out. I'm out. Fuck y'all. Have fun with.
So, Rob, I was actually just thinking in the exact opposite direction as you were saying this. Was starting to like come together for me. The speech about the green to me makes this movie feel like it is not about magic leaving the world. In fact, right? It is about the ways in which people try to insulate themselves from it and never can. It is impossible to do so. And so, you know, even if the giants walk away, even though there is this moment of encountering something truly strange and incomprehensible, there will always be another. There is no bringing, like, Dev Patel's character is on a heroic journey, but he is not bringing magic back to the world or watching it leave. It is just happening to him because this is the fun, like, underlying structure of being in this place. At least that's what I was thinking.
No, I mean, I like that reading too. It just, for me, there was something that it felt to me like they were walking out of the film in some ways or walking toward the sea. But they are crucially like they're not dying. They are not they're not going extinct. Like you see, they have their babies with them. Like it is they're on their own path. The other thing I love in that moment is, yes, when he sees them, his first instinct is, how can I instrumentalize them? Hey, could you, like, he just sees giants and like he's like, hey, they give me a lift. And that's his first reaction. But then, yes, again, he shrinks from it. And there is that realization. I love the look on the giant's face of like, oh, I didn't mean to scare you, but this realization that like we can't interact because we can't, like, we like, you do not know what to make of me, that you like, that my presence is alarming to you and it is best that I leave you to your own devices.
So my one note is Gawain doesn't jump until the fox does.
Yeah.
Gawain is chill until the fox starts freaking out, and then he's like, ah, which is, again, like the connection between these two characters is like reflections of, you know, the version of Gawain at his worst or at his most himself right now, which is kind of just like a cunning but craven person, or barely cunning, definitely craven.
Before we wrap all this up, a couple of questions that touch on things that we didn't get to in the discussion. Anonymous writes in, have you ever seen a hawk kill a horse?
So in Dwarf Fortune.
I love that little discussion and no elaboration, just you simply must see it. Like one has not lived unless they have seen a hawk swoop down and kill a horse.
Do you want a kiss, by the way?
Yeah. Oh my, I love the, like, what a toxic couple. Like, whatever you get in this house, you'll give to me. And I was like,
somebody hits him across the bar.
So here's the thing though, in the original story, in the poem, that literally happens, in which Gawain is being tempted and seduced and get, you know, exchange, like, essentially, like, I will just give you a kiss And then he also gives that kiss to the man. And that adds up to three kisses. And that, because in the poem, these are tests and he succeeds at all of them, right? Like, again, there's a much cheerier, upbeat version of the story that is told here. And so it really speaks to, it's definitely worth going to read, like, just a Wikipedia entry that summarizes the plot beats of the poem, because it shows just the really smart, twisted inversions that Lowry has taken. It's the same setup, but feels so much gnarlier in this context.
By the way, we can all agree that the kiss lands for Gawain, right? Because he's stuck there for a minute. He's standing there for about 10 seconds, sure, being like,
damn. Mm.
If I didn't have to get over to this chapel, bro, you know.
unhand me, but.
unless.
This comes. Yeah, exactly. Another question that came in from Anonymous. Casting Dev Patel as Gawain brought a racial lens to the story, which wasn't really present in the original. Though not British Indian, as a person from India who grew up in missionary schools and soaked in the remnants of British colonial culture, this muddying of who is and who can be citizens of the Empire is something that's come easy to me. I've known dudes who are just like Gawain. I'm curious what y'all think about the recent discussions about race and the stories and histories of medieval Europe. What do you think the refocusing of the lens to include more people in these settings does? Sorry for the meandering question, and dang, he sure did come. I don't know, Rob, this feels like more of a you question to at least lead off the discussion on what you make on,
well,
like the racial lens this story does or doesn't bring by the casting of Dev Patel.
I don't know. I think so. What's interesting is, I think partly what makes it work so well and maybe accomplish its end is that it doesn't really have much to say about it at all. Like, it is not making, like, Dev Patel's performance is so easy and natural in this. Like everything is so, like, yes, he and his mother are people of color in a court that is largely made of white people and, like, led by white men. But at the same time, like, I think part of what the film is, part of what the film is doing is, like, we just kind of run with it. We don't question it. You know, beyond that. So I think, like, there's that element that is working with, you know, is straight out of the gate. Is it doesn't ask us, you know, hey, can you buy Dev Patel as Sir Gawain? No, he just is Sir Gawain in this story. And we buy that completely, because, you know, in part, like, what is established so quickly is that his crisis is not necessarily one of belonging, as it is, like, really a crisis of, like, who am I in this world? So it, like, I agree, like, that it is interesting, like, the casting here is, like, operating in that vein of, like, opening up these roles and these worlds to different people and different actors. But at the same time, I don't think it's necessarily the point in this film, is like my initial reaction to that, which is interesting.
Yeah, Lowry actually was asked about this at one point. Like, hey, was this like a purposeful subversion? And, you know, that would be in line with a lot of the other sort of subversions and commentary you're doing with this take on the story. And Lowry said, the decision to cast Dev was quick and easy and based simply on liking Dev for the part, but the impact and import of this whim is not lost on me, nor was it far from my mind while we were shooting. Seeing King Arthur, which is very funny that he references King Arthur specifically here, but doesn't do it in the script. Seeing King Arthur look him in the eye and say, quote, it is good to have one's family by one's side, one's blood, was incredibly important to me. So it's one of those things where, like, you can see where there is weight to it in the story, but I think that lines up, Rob, with your reading of the situation, that this was just the character, the actor. But it's interesting to see how Lowry himself sees where that gets some additional weight by virtue of the casting.
Do any of us know Arthurian legend enough to know, if I'm remembering correctly, that Morgan is not actually blood related to Arthur? Is this something I'm making up?
There's a few different things I think that are like.
Well, that's the thing with Arthurian legend too. It's like right, how many like fucking different versions.
I think there's one where like, I think there's a version where like literally it's straight up an incestuous union, and like Mordred is the result of that. Right. There are, but I think there's also versions where like Morgan Le Fay is like a fairy lover of Arthur's, but not like related. So I think it's one of those things that different versions of the cycle like do different things with. And I think I think there might also be a couple different characters that sometimes get unified into one.
My only thought here is that like, this, like Rob was talking about earlier, this movie is about, in a way, about cycles, or not about cycles, but a way like stories cycle and affect people. And so like, I do think about the ways in which, you know, this is an interrogation of Arthurian legend as like a cultural lesson, as a cultural object, right? In the ways in which like cultural objects shift and change and become different over time. And so like, there are a ton of things where like the cultural imaginary of what Arthurian legend looks like is naturally going to shift over time. This is, I also think a lot about like, a thing we haven't talked about at all is the costume design in this movie, which is fucking crazy. The costume design in this movie is absolutely wild and ranges from like things that feel mostly correct to
cozy sweater time at the Lord's house.
Right. Like I could buy that. I can go buy that right now. And in this way, like is, you know, this narrative being brought into a different cultural imaginary in which different people can and do fill these roles because they always have.
And I think that's going to bring us to a conclusion on our conversation about The Green Knight. I am delighted that everyone enjoyed it as much as I was hoping. I told Rob this during the break that I was nervous. I was like, oh, I think everyone's really gonna like this. And I shouldn't have said that because what if people don't like it? Like, it's not a big deal. But I'm glad that everyone seemed to get as much out of it as I was hoping. The Green Knight is a really good film, and I'm glad we had a chance to for me and Kato reconsider it, and Ren and Rob to consider it for the first time, which is a delight. Where we go next, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, is due to be determined by the listeners,
by the people.
So the way we did this last time was there will be sometime in the next week or so a poll that goes up that will first be distributed through the Waypoint Plus newsletter, so that Plus members will get more or less the chance to weigh in on where we go next. Each of us will pick a film that we can branch off from this. You'll pick the one that we talk about, and then the cycle will begin anew as we move forward in time along our time. I think maybe after that we should have a brief moment to consider where we have gone on all of these movies so far. I think we're like 10 movies, and it's a wild ride from Prey to The Green Knight.
We finished our second cycle.
We have finished our second cycle. If you'd like to, the whole reason we're able to do this, if you'd like to support what we do, head to waypointplus.com. You get access to podcasts like this a whole week in advance. You get ad-free versions of the podcast, like Waypoint Radio. You allow us to do things like not play the Harry Potter game by going to waypointplus.com. And so if you'd like to support that work, or non-work, as it were, please go to waypointplus.com and support what we're doing. If not, if you can't do that, it's okay. Look, things are weird right now. If the least you could do, help us head towards 2,000 reviews on iTunes. Get over there. Like, just do a little review. You could even be like, what was it, Jake Buddy? Booty? The person who gave us one star? Yeah. Like, be that. You know what? It's still a review. It still counts towards the 2,000. So would appreciate that as well. You can follow my work personally over at Patrick Klupik. Ren, where can people follow you?
You can follow me on Twitter at Ren or Raven.
Rob.
At Rob Zachney.
Kato.
At @A_Kato_appears.
You can follow Waypoint at Twitter. You can follow archives to various things at twitch.tv/waypoint, youtube.com/waypointvice. That's going to do it for my turn. The next time, hey, it's your turn.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.